Hi, I'm Sophie, and this is Age Well with Dr. Sophie Schotter, a space where, together with my producer Fee, I talk to good friends and trusted experts on how they age well, whether it's their latest supplement stack, what's on their bathroom shelf, or a new biohacking device that really seems to work. Because for me, aging well is all about looking and feeling like the best possible version of ourselves, both inside as well as out. Remember, you can also find even more ideas and expert tips on my social channels at Dr. Sophie Schotter. I'd love you to come and join me over there too. So this is my show. Welcome along. As always, thank you so much for listening. This week, we're chatting to Tom Baxter from Bristol Fungarium. A quick note to say that we had a few small technical issues and the audio just occasionally drops out, but it's perfectly listenable. And I really would urge you to stay listening because I think this is one of the most powerful episodes we've done, and Tom has some truly fascinating things to say, all of it wedded to the latest science and data. So let's get into it. This is Tom Baxter and our deep dive into functional mushrooms. Tom, I want to start by offering my congratulations because Bristol Fungarium offers the UK's first organic certified medicinal mushrooms. I can't wait to get into the mushrooms themselves, but just to say, so far I've done actually a couple of episodes on mushrooms, one on mushrooms in skincare and the other on microdosing with psilocybin from an educational perspective. But first, what's your founder story? How did you get into all of this? And also, just as importantly, why?
Well, I guess I've always foraged for mushrooms from a young age. I grew up in Longleat Forest, so I've spent a huge amount of time. I've been all over the world looking for mushrooms. I've been to Siberia, all over the place. And I lived in the south of France for quite a few years in the foothills of the Pyrenees. So I took my brood of children frequently up the mountains, absolutely adamant that it was perfect conditions for mushrooms. And on about 90% of the occasions, we resulted in finding next to nothing. Yeah, I think this is the nature of a forager's existence. But the reason I'm actually doing what we're doing now is around about 8 or 9 years ago, we'd moved back to the UK and I'd set up a couple of nursery schools, Montessori nursery schools, and we had a forest school as well. And I basically just was a little bit perturbed by the ecological state of the world and decided that I would just work some land and stop being part of the problem and try and be part of the solution. Before that, I'd had a few years where I'd been fortunate enough to sell a couple of businesses, and I had a couple of years early retirement, age 30, and had spent quite a bit of time with climate scientists and organised a few European speaking tours for US sort of evolutionary biologists. And I'd been a part of something called AMEC, which was the Arctic Methane Emergency Group, with a couple of quite senior polar scientists from Cambridge, before sort of Extinction Rebellion, everyone getting motivated to try and do things. So I was conscious of what the science was saying from a species level perspective and wanted to just basically hunker down and work some land and try and look after a small part of England in an organic. And that was a stupid idea. Unbelievably hard work and financially not very viable. So I needed something that didn't require sunlight to create energy. In the winter months where my revenue collapsed due to a lack of photosynthesis. And so I started growing mushrooms, basically because I needed money. It's that simple. I mean, I'd always had an interest in them, but I think quite often necessity is the mother of invention. So that's why I started growing mushrooms. I needed to feed my children.
Yeah, that's fair enough and very honest. Bristol Fungarium has been name-checked by so many reputable people, and we know that you have some very interesting customers using your mushrooms for all kinds of things. We do, though, want to talk about the data that's emerging from various clinical trials, but can you first introduce us to a few of the mushrooms and what some of this emerging data is telling us? Can we start with what I think is your bestseller, and that's lion's mane? I reckon this has now become almost a byword for helping combat brain fog in perimenopausal women. It's been incredible for me. I think there's now, though, compelling data coming out of various Alzheimer's studies. Can you simplify some of this for us and talk to us about lion's mane?
Yeah, I mean, I think lion's mane has its own marketing department. And there was a couple of studies in Japan looking at early onset dementia patients and taking lion's mane over a 16-week period and being tested every 4 weeks on an international cognition test. But we're looking at sort of 40 people on both sides, so it's not a large study. But interestingly, at the end of 16 weeks, the improvement on these international cognition tests was around about 14%. What's even more interesting is they then didn't give them any lion's mane for the last 4 weeks, and they tested them again at 20 weeks, and all the scores fell back down to where they were at the start. So it is indicative of there being something within the lion's mane that the body is making use of, and when it doesn't have access to those compounds, it can't make use of them. So one of the sort of research projects we've got ongoing is with a PhD under Tim at the neuroscience department at UWE. And so we're looking at whether or not lion's mane can have an effect on these nerve cells, in essence. What we do there is we wash them with polysaturated fats that basically restrict the growth of them. And then we wash them in a very weak dilution of our lion's mane tincture to see if that encourages new growth. Now, for about the first 5 months, all that we could find is that we could kill the cells quite effectively with our lion's mane tincture, which Tim always assured us meant that there was biological activity taking place, which was a positive. We've managed after about 6 months to find a level whereby the lion's mane tincture is actually encouraging new growth. And so there are various in vitro and in vivo studies that have been done. There's various rodent studies. But in terms of the human studies, there's a lot of circumstantial evidence, but not a huge amount in terms of large-scale human clinical double-blind placebo trials. Mm. And so certainly circumstantially, we hear a lot. But again, the placebo is a real thing. And I think we're operating slightly above placebo level. Interestingly, with lion's mane, in traditional Chinese medicine, it was actually prescribed for upper digestive tract issues, so sort of acid reflux type symptoms. And what is quite interesting is that they have now isolated a compound that is used as an adjunct for esophagus cancer. And what's interesting is that quite often esophagus cancer is caused by a very large acid buildup at the top of your stomach, basically melting away the membrane around the bottom of the esophagus and opening it up to, you know, various issues further down the line. Given the relationship between the gut biome and the brain, we fundamentally don't know a huge amount. We know that there are a lot of compounds in lion's mane that have the sort of diterpenes and have very low molecular weight that seem to be able to cross the blood. Well, don't seem to be. They can cross the blood-brain barrier, and they seem to create the precursor to an enzyme which encourages nerve growth, so NGF, nerve growth factor. And certainly circumstantially, again, we've had a lot of people with strokes, and it's quite often their partner who tells us about the improvement they've seen. So I think there is reason to be hopeful that this does seem to have an impact on a large amount of people, but the actual scientific basis in terms of proper large-scale human clinical trials isn't really there, and more research is needed. I think one of the issues we've got is that the model we currently operate under, unless you're isolating out a compound and using that to treat a specific condition, there's not a lot of profit in proving that a broad extraction from a lion's mane is efficacious against whatever it may be, dementia, Alzheimer's, because there's no profit motive. You know, anyone who's then doing a reasonable job of extracting from lion's mane could make the same claim. It's an interesting reality that we find ourselves in.
This is everything we've spoken about with Professor Nutt on cannabis and other things, and with Tracy T on psilocybin. So we're back to the old issue of everything you've said and funding for research. But fascinating. Thank you.
I think a lot of people don't realise the interesting impacts mushrooms have on the body in terms of, for example, their ability to regulate certain systems. And of course, when you take traditional medicine, it's usually to block something, whereas mushrooms are adaptogenic rather than being boosters or fighters. Can we talk maybe a little bit about reishi mushrooms and their ability to regulate the nervous system? And I'm also really interested in how reishi interacts with cytokines, which are inflammatory molecules in the body, and the immune system. And would reishi be your first choice for anyone who suffers with anxiety or sleep issues?
Reishi, of all the mushrooms, is probably the go-to mushroom. It's also been the most studied. And interestingly, from a sort of historical perspective, it was the one that was restricted to the emperor and his family for about 300 years. There's a certain group of compounds that are broadly under the term triterpenes, but specifically within reishi, they're called ganoderic acids, based on the fact that Ganoderma is the Latin genus name for reishi. The ganoderic acids have a very similar molecular structure to cortisol, and it appears that they can attach onto the same receptors as cortisol and therefore block some of the receptors that cortisol would normally attach onto. And we think, if we were to have a guess, the reason a large proportion of people with certain complex pathologies, especially around pain, so fibromyalgia, and if we were to have an educated guess, which means we're probably completely wrong, it's the ability of reishi to regulate the stress function within the microglia cells, within the central nervous system, that may explain why people are experiencing this change from a pain perspective. And for the people who do experience this, it's extraordinary. Like, we've had, it's mainly women, to be honest, who within 4 or 5 days of taking reishi are pain-free. It's kind of extraordinary to know what's causing it. What we also do, as opposed to, I think, pretty much every other company in the UK, is we also have an analytical chemist who's ex-Pfizer and Glaxo, and he does a lot of UPLC and HPLC analysis for us. So we're able to count specific ganoderic acids. And because we know that it's ganoderic acid A and E that seem to be the anti-inflammatory ones, we know the molecular weight of these compounds in 1 mil of our tincture. And so it's one of the, it is pretty much the first tincture that we do that we know that we have a low pharmaceutical dose of these ganoderic acids in our reishi tincture. Reishi traditionally is given for high blood pressure. And what's interesting is one of the elements to reishi is that it opens up your capillaries and allows your body to hold more oxygen, which in turn means that your heart doesn't have to beat as fast in order to keep the body oxygenated. Unfortunately, that means it contraindicates with certain blood thinning medication, especially antiplatelet medication. This is another unfortunate reality with the regulatory framework in the UK, because mushrooms are not, unlike herbs, are viewed as having no medicinal value whatsoever. We're unable to state any contraindications, even though we've had umpteen people ring us up and say we're feeling absolutely terrible after they've taken our reishi, and they're always on blood pressure meds. And so the other big reason people take it is for joint pain. And if we look at the potential mechanism, it is probably caused by, as you mentioned earlier, a regulation of cytokine release. So cytokines, as you point out, are a sort of protein within the immune system. They're like sort of the signaling enzyme, in essence. So they'll go to the point of, let's say you've got rheumatoid arthritis, for example, it's in your finger. So they'll go down to the finger, the joint finger, where it's plaguing, and they should then tell the immune system what to send down there to deal with the issue. But quite often, what we're finding in a lot of, especially autoimmune type conditions, is that just more and more cytokines are being sent down there. So I think around 60% of visible inflammation in the body is caused by an overproduction of cytokines, and reishi to be able to regulate cytokine release.
So interesting, because again, we're back to the issue of if we had the data and the studies, you could make those claims, including about the contraindications, as you say. Staying on this theme of inflammation, as a breast cancer survivor, I'm really interested in turkey tail. I know that, like Sophie, you're wedded to the data and not keen on making unsubstantiated claims, and you haven't so far. But can we broadly talk about medicinal mushrooms and cancer? What do we know? Where are the studies taking us, even if they are small scale?
This is the one area where there are actually human clinical trials. There is one decent cohort of humans that have been given medicinal mushrooms when they've had cancer. And there are lots and lots of studies looking at people with various different types of cancer taking medicinal mushrooms alongside traditional therapy, be it chemo or radiotherapy. This is the one area where there is actually evidence. It's fair to say that in the vast majority of cases, the long-term survival rates at 1, 3, and 5 years, which is unfortunately the sort of brutal statistic that's used to sort of demonstrate efficacy, almost across the board, including actually pancreatic cancer, interestingly, the people that are taking the mushrooms alongside chemo and radiotherapy have around about, well, basically year 1, year 3, and year 5, around 30% of people are still with us. 30% more people are still with us as opposed to the group that are not. And what is interesting is that there are now 9 adjunct treatments for cancer that are isolates of compounds in the mushrooms. The majority of the compounds of those 9, 7 of them are beta-glucans, which is a type of sort of structural polysaccharide. And the interesting thing with the fungi beta-glucans is their molecular structure. They spike off the 3rd and 6th carbon atom, and that shape is recognized by human immune receptor cells. And so that's the reason why you're seeing this improvement in people being alive at 1, 3, and 5 years.
Is it turkey tail that is the main mushroom?
So what's interesting about turkey tail, so for example, with turkey tail, there are 2 relatively well-known adjunct treatments for cancer called PSK and PSP, which is polysaccharide peptin and polysaccharide crestin. Now, they were both isolated. One was in the 80s and one was in the early 90s by a Japanese and a Chinese company. And so actually in Japan, I think yearly spend on PSP and PSK is around $3 billion. So it's the second, they're the second and third most prescribed adjunct treatments for cancer over there. So they both from turkey tail, but those are the only 2 from turkey tail. So there's one from reishi, there's one from maitake, there's 2 from shiitake. All mushrooms have fungi beta glucans in them. Turkey tail has the highest density per gram of dried mushroom. It's just that from the PSP and PSK, basically, they've been able to easily commercialize them. So once you've found the compound you're interested in, with mushrooms, you no longer grow the mushroom. You then basically grow the mycelium in large bioreactors and you pre-treat it with an enzyme and keep a pH at a certain level for the mycelium to express more of that particular compound. And so what's interesting with both PSP and PSK, they weren't actually the most efficacious beta-glucan in turkey tail. They were just the 2 that they could easily commercially scale. But if you were to look at, we tried to work out, I don't know, a year or two ago, how much PSP is in one of our tinctures and how much you would have to take in order to like have the sort of pharmaceutical dose that's prescribed. And it is biblically high. I mean, it would be like taking the equivalent of sort of 15 bottles of our tincture a day to have the same amount of that one particular compound. But there are actually about 60 to 70 different fungi beta glucans in turkey tail. And so with, for example, a broad extraction like we do, you're getting a much larger number of beta glucans, but you're not getting anything like the same quantity of that particular beta-glucan that you would be if you were taking the pharmaceutical product. And so it is the fungi beta-glucans that are across all mushrooms that are the regulatory ones that are used in alongside cancer treatments.
What about cordyceps? I heard you say on another podcast that this is the mushroom you reckon people will get really excited about over the next few years. It seems to have a really interesting effect on things like mood and also sex drive. It also seems to have a tangible impact that works above placebo level. What do we know so far scientifically and anecdotally, what are people telling you?
So, yeah, cordyceps is an interesting one. So, traditionally, Cordyceps sinensis is the mushroom that everyone is wild foraged in the high plateaus of the Himalayas, so in Bhutan, China, India, Pakistan to a degree. Now, it's a parasitic fungus that grows off the pupae of a ghost moth out there. Now, It's traditionally been used by the Sherpas for going high up the mountains. It's traditionally been used as an aphrodisiac. Now, because the wild Cordyceps sinensis strain is currently selling at nearly $50,000 a kilo. So it is probably the most expensive mushroom out there, and you can't actually, it's very difficult to export it from China. And also the actual numbers that are being harvested are falling, probably because of the reality of a changing climate. And so about 30 years ago, a different type of mushroom called Cordyceps, another Cordyceps called Cordyceps militaris, was commercially produced, because Cordyceps sinensis you cannot commercially produce unless you've specifically got the pupae of that ghost moth, but it takes about 580 days to fruit, so it's not a very commercially viable product. Cordyceps sinensis is the one that everyone is growing now, and actually grows in the wild in Europe as well. The interesting elements to Cordyceps militaris, the things that are, from a sort of endocrine perspective, it's exceptionally useful from a thyroid function. So actually the guy that set up the largest cordyceps farm in the US did so, he was a biochemist, did so because he claimed that he cured his Lyme's disease through taking cordyceps. And definitely with conditions like Graves, Hashimoto's and Lyme's, we do see, both for hypo and hyperthyroid issues, it does seem to be amazingly effective. And I think that's potentially, from a mood perspective, what seems to be beneficial from a regulatory angle. But I think the main reason we see people taking it is from an energy perspective. There's a compound in it called cordycepin and another one called adenosine, and they increase aerobic function through increasing ATP function. So basically, in a simple way, like how much oxygen at a cellular level you can burn. It's not massive, but it's between 6% and 12%. And interestingly, the least fit you are, the bigger the impact it seems to have. So we actually have quite a few, maybe 50 plus now, professional athletes that take it. And so, you know, there are various reports back in, I think it was in the early 80s, when the Chinese Olympic team, I think it was their swimming team, did exceptionally well. And they all claim they're on cordyceps. I don't doubt they're on cordyceps, but I think they're probably on, you know, various anabolic steroids at the same time. But the cordyceps definitely had a part, probably not quite as dominant a part as some of the anabolic steroids. But there is, in terms of the amount of research being done, it is the one which is getting probably the most research funding at the moment. So there are lots of new studies coming out. I mean, the slightly brutal study they do for, got rats and you swim them till they perish. The length of time rats swim when they're on cordyceps, as opposed to the length of time when they're not, they swim 3.5 times further.
Three and a half times further
when they're on the cordyceps than when they're not. Obviously, there's not a large crossover between the rodent studies and humans, but I think when it's to do with sort of capacity type studies, there's probably more of a crossover than testing for Alzheimer's or whatever it may be.
This is interesting, because in terms of taking the mushrooms, I'm hearing you talk and thinking, I want to take all of them, the whole range. What are your thoughts on picking the right ones for you? Because there is a temptation to buy the lot and use the lot. Should we do that? Or if not, why shouldn't we do that? And what do you take as well?
I think the thing is, with all these things, it's much better to be like conscious of what you're taking. So whenever someone buys multiple tinctures from us, we always suggest that you should just start with one for a week and be conscious of any changes. Because what's interesting, I know a lot of sort of supplement brands say you've got to take these things for months before you experience the benefits. If I refer back to the lion's mane study, for example, when they weren't taking them, scores dropped rapidly in a very short period of time. And I think with our products, you should actually be able to notice the difference in a much shorter period of time. So we always suggest starting with one for a week, then introducing another one, just so that you can be conscious of any changes. And fundamentally, if you don't notice any change, there's no need to spend money. Accept it and move on. Unless you've got an acute condition, like an autoimmune type condition, where you don't really care which one it is, you just want to see if change does occur. And so probably 20% of our customers are at some point along a cancer journey. And I think in that sense, you're probably better off just taking three, because there is quite a bit of evidence for sort of an entourage effect, whereby, you know, giving it, there's around 200 bioactive compounds in each mushroom. So similar to sort of things like curcumin and the sort of powerhouses from the herbal world, from the plant kingdom. And giving your body access to around 600 is more likely, your body's more likely to be able to make use of some of them. And certainly the outcomes that we see and hear, especially with more complex pathologies, there does seem value in taking more than one. If you're taking it from a wellness perspective, based on where you are in your life and you're looking to regulate certain functions within the body, then I think being conscious of the effects that each individual one has is probably a much better way of going about it, because you just don't need to spend money if it's not making any difference.
And what do you take? What's your current routine? Do you switch it up?
Well, I always have quite a lot on my desk, so it's largely dependent what I grab. For me, personally, I take maitake quite a lot. That's probably the one I take most, well, along with cordyceps. You know, because we farm all of the mushrooms we use, apart from chaga, which you can't farm, maitake is the most temperamental of any of the mushrooms. And so I think part of it is because it's by far the hardest one to actually cultivate and grow. I think there's that sort of innate respect I have for that particular fungi. Also, it's very good at regulating insulin. It seems to change the mucosity in the lower intestine, which seems to be where a lot of the insulin exchange takes place. And so, interestingly, with Tim at the neuroscience department, who was at Oxford for 8 years doing research on diabetes, he's got a cell line that's very good for testing insulin sensitivity. And so we're actually going to be doing some tests this year looking at both maitake and chaga for insulin sensitivity. And so, because we hear so much from people with diabetes claiming that they're injecting, you know, 20% of the amount of insulin they used to on a daily basis since they started taking whichever one it may be. And so we like stuff like that because quite often we get feedback and it's people are feeling so much more focused or feeling this or that, which is great. And I don't doubt for them that's real. But from our perspective, numbers are more believable. And so for diabetics that are injecting insulin, for example, if they're injecting a lot less insulin every day and the only thing they've changed is they've started taking some of our tinctures, then I'm more comfortable believing that there is a correlation there. So yeah, I mean, I take cordyceps in the morning and I take maitake during the day, but I would say of all the mushrooms, it's reishi that has the biggest impact on the broadest number of people by a mile.
And besides mushrooms, what else do you take day to day that falls into the wellness space? So, for example, do you take any other supplements?
I'm a bit old school. I spend a lot of time outdoors, and that's about it. Just organic food, and try and buy stuff from as nearby as possible. So I just try and source everything from that I eat from probably 10 miles of here, which does mean at this time of year, there's a few more Swedes.
A lot of potatoes.
Yeah, then I perhaps like acknowledging that we are part of our environment and be in time with the earth. You know, it's what poor people have done the entirety of their existence, because, you know, you are attached to the earth. And I think, you know, being aware that, like, at different times of year, you can eat different things. And, you know, I was an organic veg grower for quite a few years, so, you know, I got accustomed to there being nothing in the ground other than root veg or beetroot or whatever. And so I think just being out in nature, doing physical things, at least for me, and from a supplement perspective, I am solely taking mushrooms. I think the thing is, like, if you can regulate insulin, that's a really good thing. Also, maitake is very good for colon cancer. They've isolated a compound called defraction, which is an adjunct that they use for colon cancer. And what's quite interesting is that in traditional Chinese herbalism, for lower intestinal tract issues, they would prescribe maitake. And now defraction has been isolated and is used as an adjunct for colon cancer. So there's another one. I mean, don't get me wrong, there's lots of examples within traditional Chinese herbalism where there is absolutely zero correlation between the traditional folk usage and any actual science to back it up. But there are quite a few examples with mushrooms.
Yeah. Well, we're going to put a load of links in the show notes. Thank you.
And Before we let you go, Tom, the brand is beautiful. Can you tell us how you developed this and how you approached marketing and growing a business? Did it take an age? Any things you wished you knew back in the day? And also any tips to pass on, especially with regards to things like PR and advertising?
Okay, yeah. So we're slightly unique, I think, in this regard. In terms of branding, that took a long time. It was three different people at various different moments when I had any available cash. But basically, it was down to our friend Fan, who I think is an exceptionally competent designer and has been on contract at Ogilvy for many, many years and kindly took the brand together. And Elle, my partner, who comes from a sort of branding and marketing perspective, she really was responsible for making Henry and I slightly more competent in every shape and form. So from an advertising perspective, well, until about 6 months ago, we hadn't really spent anything on advertising. So we do a lot of sort of in-person stuff, be it trade shows, markets. We still do 4 or 5 markets a week. You know, might not need to anymore financially, but I think having the ability to interact with humans on a face-to-face basis is very, very valuable, especially in the world that we're in now where it's, you know, not such a common occurrence. And so I think in terms of how we've managed to get to where we are with zero ad spend pretty much on socials or Google, I mean, I think last year, I think we spent about £3,000 up to sort of October last year. We've actually spent a bit more in the last 6 months just because we haven't, until now, we haven't had the money. Problem is with spending money on research and spending money counting compounds from an analytical chemistry perspective, that doesn't improve your bottom line. You'd be much better off spending that on marketing. I think the thing is, expect that things are going to take a lot longer because we have not taken any investment either. Where we're slightly different to most other brands in our space, we're never going to be able to scale massively because of the fact that we grow everything ourselves. So in order to scale, we have to scale the agricultural side, the farming side, and we're already cropping 400 kilos a week of mushrooms, making 3 or 4 tons of substrate a week. So we're doing a lot of graft. It's not a very relaxed, calm environment. I think if you want to build a company in the modern world, it's very easy to do if you've got money, because you can spend. We're not complicated as a species, humans. We're quite easy to manipulate. We're quite easy to control. There are touch points for emotional beings. So I think for us, it's been, we've had to take a slightly different path because of the fact we've had no money and we haven't taken investment and we can't scale like other businesses. So I would just say to anyone that's trying to do it, it's going to take a long time. It was only really of the last 5 years, of the last 70 months, we've only really been profitable for 5 out of those 70 months. It's not an easy or relaxing or good for your relationships. I think for 5 years, I think I went on holiday twice, but never for longer than 5 days. So the last 6 months, I went for the first time ever for longer, well, the first time in 6 years for longer than a week. But it was fungi related. We went and did the first sort of survey in Barbados since 1948. And I can assure you, taking a 9-month-old into the jungle in 38 degrees with a machete looking for mushrooms is not the most relaxing holiday. So everyone else is enjoying, you know, I mean, the beaches look beautiful in Barbados, but I can tell you the jungles are brutal. But it was nice. We did spend some time on the beach, normally at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, about an hour. So yeah, if you want a life, I wouldn't suggest being a farmer.
Well, I would absolutely 100% recommend Bristol Fungarium. You can find them online and on socials at bristolfungarium.com. Thank you so much, Tom, for joining us and for sharing your knowledge and your passion and your expertise.
Thank you very much, both of you.
And that ends this week's podcast. If you want to find out more about me and my work, or maybe book a consultation, head to drsophieschotter.com and you can find me on socials at drsophieschotter. And again, thank you so much for listening.